evening. You're listening to Outsources, a KGNU Boulder Denver program that brings you stimulating and thoughtful perspectives on the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer communities. I'm Angela Palermo, your host for the evening. As always, I'm happy to be here with you for another episode of Colorado's only homegrown, regularly scheduled LGBT-themed radio show. I'm really excited to speak with tonight's guest. I think we Americans are all aware that the election of Donald Trump to the highest office in the land has helped spur a greater visibility of the extreme right, not just in this country, but in other parts of the world as well. Nations as diverse as the United States, France, Austria, Poland, Egypt, and the Philippines have witnessed a resurgence of the far right and authoritarian rule in general. It's been a troubling trend for folks committed to democracy, equality, and just plain human decency. Resistance to this rightward movement by the left and center segments of the political spectrum has likewise become engaged and empowered to combat the right's ascendancy in the U.S. and elsewhere. The battle has been joined. The Democrats' rather sweeping triumphs in the elections of 2017 may point the way to further electoral successes in the 2018 midterm contest. What happens in the future depends in large measure on how effective the right and its more progressive opponents in the resistance are at marshaling their forces in the battles yet to come. Where we go from here is truly up for grabs. With me on the phone to discuss the past, present, and future of the far right and its opponents is Angela King. Growing up in South Florida, Angela struggled with her identity. She became confused about the messages she received from her church and family on issues like sexual identity and racial stereotypes. Disenfranchised, Angela began acting out and felt welcomed for the first time by a group of skinheads. Though the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing made Angela reconsider her beliefs, she knew that abandoning her skinhead affiliates would result in retaliation. Angela was arrested in 1998 and sentenced to 6 years in prison for her part in an armed robbery of a Jewish-owned store. She was released from prison 3 years early in 2001 for good behavior. She has graduated from the University of Central Florida with an MA in Interdisciplinary Studies. Angela works as a keynote speaker, consultant, and character educator. Welcome, Angela, and thanks for taking the time to be on Outsources.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
It's always great to meet another Angela.
It is.
Getting started, wondering if you might tell our audience a little bit about yourself. When and where did you grow up?
Sure. I grew up in South Florida. I'm 42, so 70s, 80s, 90s down there.
What were your early experiences in life made you vulnerable to recruitment into the neo-Nazi skinhead movement? Tell us about young Angela and her tweens and early teens.
Sure. Young Angela was a confused young woman. And she grew up in a household where she was taught racism, homophobia. From as early as I can remember, hearing racial slurs, hearing, you know, stereotypical jokes or so-called jokes, I'll say. And my parents were not religious, but they insisted on having a great deal of organized religion in our household. So I attended a private Baptist school up in through the fifth grade and at the same time attended Catholic services and went through my communion and all of that. And from a very early age, I suffered an identity crisis. I realized early on that I was gay, but I didn't know what it was. I only knew that I had this feeling that if anyone found out, that horrible things would happen to me. So I pictured things like being excommunicated from my family or being stoned to death or burning in the everlasting pits of hell if I was found out. So this created a lot of turmoil for me very early on.
We've mentioned the fact that you got out of the racist skinhead movement. Give us a sense of what drove you to abandon a movement into which you had poured your talents, energy, and commitment.
Sure. Getting involved in a movement like that, although it may seem otherwise, individuals don't get involved simply because they wake up one day and decide they hate everyone. For me, it was a case that I hated myself, was very confused about who I was. I also suffered through some trauma, abuse, bullying, And by the time I got involved with the violent far right, I was willing to trade just about anything, including my soul, just to belong somewhere and to feel like I was accepted. So I literally spent about 8 years with my entire identity wrapped up in the belief in the violence and ran as far from who I really was as I could possibly get. I spent between the ages of 15 and 23 involved in the violent far right. And at the age of 23, I went to federal prison for my part in an armed robbery of a Jewish owned store that was a hate crime. And I went into prison first thinking that I wasn't responsible. I literally was telling myself, well, I just sat in the car. I'm not responsible. I'll get out of this. And then when it started to sink in that I was responsible and that I was going to be in prison, my initial thoughts from there were that I was going to have to defend myself for whatever time I was there because it was a hate crime case. And I had a lot of fear and conflicting emotions. What ended up happening was I was completely disarmed by being treated kindly and with compassion by women I felt I didn't deserve it from. And that change started with a simple question that was, hey, do you know how to play cribbage? That was asked by a Jamaican woman that I eventually became very close with. So during the 3 years in prison, several things happened. But to sum it up, I learned to take responsibility for myself no matter what happened to me in my life, how I was raised. I was responsible for all of my own decisions and actions. Equally important, when others were able to view me as a human being, even if I didn't act like one, even if I wouldn't necessarily treat others the same way before then, I was able to view myself as a human being again. And when that happened, it was like a floodgate opened up. Being in prison, one has an awful lot of time to think and to ponder over the past. So I did a lot of thinking about what led me to that point in my life. And I started to accept myself for who I was and to not be ashamed of myself. It literally started simple as an act of kindness.
Well, I know from the Life After Hate website that you had developed doubts about neo-Nazism and white supremacy in the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. Can you tell our listeners more about those doubts? How nagging were they? Were they at a low level the first few years, or did they slowly build until they exploded when you were leaving the movement?
When the Oklahoma City bombing happened in 95, I was 19 years old and I had been involved in the violent far right for years already. There were things that I witnessed in the far right that were not what I expected. There's a lot of drama and infighting and people trying to compete with one another there. So there were some things that were already nagging at the back of my mind, but I still very much craved acceptance and belonging and was on a really self-destructive path. When I saw the initial footage on television about what happened in Oklahoma City, I can't say that I was completely unmoved by it, but I didn't make a connection until they started talking about Timothy McVeigh and who he was and what his motivations were. And it slowly dawned on me that he was someone like me. All of these questions started to come up in my mind. For instance, as a woman involved in the violent far right, women put in very conflicting roles. And on one hand, women are expected to literally be pregnant barefoot in the kitchen. We are told our most important job in life is to have white children. We're also expected to be subservient to men, expected to be in a supportive role, but simultaneously expected to be up to date on all the latest conspiracy theories and information about the beliefs, the ideology. We're expected to act with violence and aggression if necessary. Having these realizations that on one hand, I was being told these are all the things that are expected of me, this is who I'm supposed to be, but then seeing the mass destruction and the fact that children were killed, innocent people were killed, I in a very immature, and I wouldn't say a highly intellectual way, just made some adjustments in my thinking and thought, if I have children, I don't want to expose them to this. I don't want to be a murderer. I'm not willing to commit these acts of violence. So it wasn't necessarily the beliefs that changed at that point. It was what I was willing to do and what I wasn't willing to do. But I think those were the first cracks of doubt, really, that over the years, they were doubts that would surface that I would try my best to push down. And I was on a very self-destructive path and went to great lengths not to think about things, did drugs and drank a lot and just took part in mindless things to try to keep my attention away from the deeper critical thoughts and feelings that I was experiencing. But to be really honest with you, being involved in what I was involved in isn't the kind of thing that one just wakes up one day and says, hey, I've changed my mind, have a nice life, I'm changing my life now. So during that time, my action was, I'll quit hanging out with these people, I'll quit being involved in the activities. And when I cut off the contact, it wasn't but a few weeks before I was getting reminders that that was unacceptable. And those reminders, to give a few examples, one day I woke up and the front of the building I lived in was covered in bullet holes. And on another occasion, shortly thereafter, I received a phone call from someone I was associated with who let me know that they just saw my little brother, who is 11 years younger than me, so he was quite young at that time, that they just saw him playing outside of my mom's house by himself. Those subtle threats, coupled with my need for acceptance and belonging, kept me there until I went to prison and made the final break.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU. I'm your host, Angela Palermo. Today, we're speaking with Angela King. Angela is a neo-Nazi skinhead who grew up in Florida. After growing doubts, a prison term, and coming out as queer, she left the racist skinhead movement. She is also co-founder of the anti-hate group Life After Hate.
I'm tired of weakness, tired of my feet of clay. I'm tired of days to come. I'm tired of yesterday. And all the worn out things that I ever said, now it's much too late. The words stay in my head.
So the day will begin again. Take comfort from me. It's up to you now. You're still here and you're digging again. That's comfort to you. It's up to you now. So pariah, you'll begin again.
Angela, what was it like to be in prison as a convicted white supremacist? How did your fellow white supremacists in prison react when you fell in love with a black woman behind bars? And how did the African-American women at the prison treat you and your lover after that relationship became public?
Going into prison, this was the late 90s, I was lucky that I went to federal prison because there's a completely different dynamic in the federal system, at least, you know, for women. So going in there, I was not, to my knowledge, incarcerated with other white supremacists. The way that I was received by women of color, it was different. You know, it wasn't the same across the board. Some women were hostile toward me, and I can't say that I blame them in any way. I was covered in racist tattoos. Still, you know, very confused and becoming even more confused as the paranoia and the things that I had adopted as my own beliefs started to unravel there. Everything I had been taught about people who were different than me was wrong completely. And instead of having experiences on my own to have a base and have something to compare to against what I was being fed by my family and by the violent far right, it was not anything like what I expected. Women of color, I had been taught I had to fear people of color, that, you know, they were out to get me and they wanted to hurt me simply because I was white. My entire world was being deconstructed, my entire belief system. And the women who were kind to me and were compassionate, you know, they were women from all over the world, from all different races and backgrounds and ethnicities. They didn't let me off the hook. It wasn't just, well, this is what you were, and we're going to forget all of that. I was asked really difficult questions. I had very difficult conversations that didn't just put me on the spot in the moment that those conversations were going on, but really led to some critical thinking and some soul searching, having to undo all the ways in which I was socialized. So I would say it definitely was not an overnight process. It was a process that went on for many years. Without those women, I can honestly say that I probably wouldn't be having this conversation with you today. And it took the strength of individuals who were able to treat me with kindness instead of aggression and hatred that really broke through to me when nothing else did.
Can you tell us more about the anti-hate group Life After Hate that you co-founded in 2010? Who are some of the other folks who were your co-founders?
Absolutely. I was released from prison in 2001, began sharing my experiences and doing outreach. I enrolled in college and did 3 degrees back to back. So after doing that for about a decade, I was invited to a conference in Dublin, Ireland in 2011, where I had the opportunity to meet a handful of other individuals from the U.S. who were also former violent far-right extremists. It was the first time that I was actually able to meet people face-to-face who had walked some of the same paths that I had. Certainly not all of them, and certainly not the specific background of being a queer woman who was raised to be racist and homophobic. They had all in common that each one of us had been involved in these things for various reasons. We were drawn in for various reasons. And at some point, I know this is kind of cliche, but we saw the light. A lot of it for each of us was being treated kindly by people we felt we didn't deserve it from. There were 6 of us co-founders all together, and we were in the middle of this beautiful courtyard in the hotel we were staying in Dublin, and there were, you know, these beautiful plants all around, and this handful of us stood around in this courtyard. We were so inspired by what we saw. Some of us had been speaking and doing outreach already. A few of the co-founders had not really gone into the foray of doing anything public. But what we all agreed on was that we could do something really powerful if we made the choice to move forward together. So literally on the spot there, we put our hands in the circle and made this commitment that we were going to come home, walk this path together. One of our original co-founders was a man named Arno Michaelis, and he had started an online journal called Life After Hate and had already been putting some thought into something like this. And he was kind enough to offer up the name Life After Hate. So that was the very end of June 2011, and by August of that year, Life After Hate was born as a nonprofit. So some of our other co-founders are Frank Meek, who is a former far-right extremist. He's been speaking for several years, a few decades actually, about his experiences in the far-right and how he got out. Another of our co-founders is named Tony McLear. He was also involved in the violent far-right and is now our board chairman. Another co-founder is Christian Picciolini. he was kind of new into that world of speaking and sharing experiences when we first started, but he has been doing that for the past few years now. And Sammy Rangel, who he is the only one of us that does not have a background with the far right. He is actually Native American and Mexican and has a background with inner city gangs and is an amazing human being. He is our executive director today.
What sort of work does Life After Hate do? Who do you work with? How many young people have you helped since the group's founding? What is your basic approach to helping young folks break with the various racist movements operating in our troubled, divisive world?
So, Life After Hate does a lot of different work. We educate. So we go out, we share our personal narratives and experiences. We do outreach, and this can be anything from speaking at high schools or religious communities or centers in broader communities, and having conversations about tough stuff that's hard to talk about, whether it's being raised with racism or homophobia or being bullied or suffering through trauma or abuse or just trying to, you know, figure out who one is in this world. We do some training and workshops. We are subject matter experts in the area of the far right in the U.S. So we're able to marry our personal narratives and experience with the expertise we have that is really unique to us as former violent extremists. We have also spent a great deal of time, you know, becoming educated ourselves. So we are able to speak on a number of topics. We all have specific specialty areas. And we do a lot of traveling given the current events of the past few years. The need for our services has grown almost beyond what we're able to fulfill. So leading up to the 2016 presidential election, we were becoming overwhelmed. And then last year, with what happened in Charlottesville, things just went over the top. Another big area that we work in is with our program, Exit USA. And that is a program that allows us to do interventions and to assist individuals who want to disengage from the violent far right, or even if they're not necessarily involved in violent extremism, but maybe hold some kind of prejudice views that they want to change or that they want to break free from. Very much like undoing a bad habit. We're also involved in research and various projects across the country. In fact, we just started a new initiative partnered with an organization agency called Possible that is called We Counter Hate. And it is an initiative to shut down hate tweets on Twitter. So essentially, someone goes to share a hate tweet from a big influencer. A message is, if it's caught, is posted for this individual to let them know that if they share that hate tweet, they will be donating to an organization that fights hate. So we're involved in lots of different initiatives. I don't have numbers off the top of my head of how many people we've helped, but I can say that in the past few years, the number of individuals who are reaching out to us either for help themselves or for loved ones has grown exponentially.
What do you see as the way forward for the anti-hate, anti-racist movement in this country or even worldwide? Considering your experience both within and without a prominent hate movement, what does the future look like?
I have to be really honest in saying that right now I'm afraid for our future. Things seem to be deteriorating on a daily basis in our country, and we're seeing concerning stuff around the world. I know it sounds very simplistic, but I always go back to what were the key things that changed for me. And why I am torn about this, because on one hand, I know without a doubt that love and kindness and compassion, these things hold the power to change the course of a human life. But I also know that in the face of hate crimes in the face of violence because of someone's race or sexual or gender identity or religion. We can't just pass out hugs to people who are willing to kill us because of these things. I try to live by example, and the way that I think about things is that if someone says something ugly to me, whether it's about my sexual identity, the way I look, no matter what it is, I try my best to remember that that person isn't coming from a place of function and happiness. They're coming from a place of pain. They wouldn't be treating other human beings like that if there wasn't something going on with them. I do my best to remember back to when I hated myself so much that it seemed okay for me to do the same things to others. I think it takes so much more strength not to react in the same way with the same level of aggression and anger and hatred. And it's not easy. I can tell you that it's something that I'm going to have to work on for the rest of my life, because sometimes all I want to do is turn around and tell someone to F off if they're rude or they have ugly, hateful things to say. But at the same time, I think that we have to be very aware of what is going on around us, what our government is doing, what they're not doing, what our current administration is taking a stand on or what they refuse to take a stand on. And we have to speak up for our fellow human beings. We have to call out hate when we see it. We have to be aware of what's going on around us. And we have to be aware of what our fellow human beings are going through. And unfortunately, I don't think there's just one right answer. I think it's going to take, a lot of effort in many different directions. And it's going to need to come from people who are truly invested in humanity and in changing the tide of hate and anger that we see happening right now.
We've been speaking with Angela King. Angela is a former neo-Nazi skinhead, originally from South Florida. She spent time in prison for robbing a Jewish-owned store and fell in love with a black woman behind bars. She co-founded Life After Hate in 2010 with other former skinhead movement members, including Christian Picciolini, who I hope to interview here on KGNU very soon. Thanks, Angela, for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Angela.
Oh, you're welcome. Please stay tuned for our events and announcements section.
Someone in a dangerous place. Someone got lost somewhere. Many people are locked outside. Many people lost out there. Well, many people they can't get in. Many people they pay no mind. Many people they leave this place. And many people afraid of time. Well, now, this man, he could be king. This woman, royalty. This woman, she's brave and strong. She's got no name, but she is family. Gasoline and dirty sheets. Politics and a painted face. She says that freedom costs too much.
There are two groups that I'd like to tell you about. The first is the LGBTQ Youth of Color group, which will meet every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. at the Longmont Youth Center at 1050 Lashley Street in Longmont. Also, there's Out and About, which is a group for gays, lesbians, bisexuals, pansexuals, asexuals, sapiosexuals, and more to share space and talk about what it's like for us at work and at home to be out and about. That group, Out and About, will meet the first and third Mondays from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Boulder Pride House, which is located at 2132 14th Street in Boulder. So for more information, please go to the Out Boulder County website.